I thought I wanted to continue on the same theme of last week. Last week I did a message called No One Fights Alone. And I was sitting and, you know, one of the big dangers when you write, if some of you write, you would know, you shouldn't always start with a title first because you can be bound by the title. I called this message Shadowboxing. I sent it to the team. They produced this. And then when I got to the end of my message, I was like, you know what? I'm not talking about shadowboxing. But it's still a great photo. It's great. I didn't want to, you know, mess it up for the team, but thanks, guys. But have you ever noticed that the older you get, the less black and white life seems? You know, when you're younger, your opinions are clear. When you're younger, it's like, this is how it is, and it's no other way. And then, you know, you see your parents maybe make a decision that it's not as, you know, black and white, and then you get angry at them because you're like, you know best, obviously, as a teenager, because you've lived so long and have so much experience to draw from. But as you get older, you realize, yeah, you have your convictions, but as you have to, you know, realize them in real life, you suddenly discover the difficulties of giving expression to that in all the various elements and experiences and cultures that you might find yourself in. And I think maybe that is why that one of the key verses that we find in the Bible to give us some context in how to live this life out of following Jesus is Proverbs 4:23, where it says, above all else, that's starting strong, above all else. It doesn't say, you know, above all else, do this. Above all else, live like this. No, above all else, guard your heart. Isn't that amazing? Above all else, I mean, if you're going to have everyone's attention, that's like, ladies and gentlemen, above all else, yes, you know, notepads out. What is it? What's the key? Guard your heart. Because everything you do flows from it. Everything flows from the condition of your heart. Have you ever noticed that people get drawn to extremes, extreme points of view, extreme opinion? It's one of the reasons. There's a few, but it's one of the reasons why I try to stay clear of debates on social media. Because it's like people live in these little extreme bubbles, these like extreme points of view. You know, we want little sound bites. We want everything to be summed up in 140 character and or less. And you just realize life is not that simple. Life is not that simple that I can say something that weighs so much that it now makes sense. That's often life is a conversation, and you realize that life is lived somewhere in the middle ground, in the gray zone. That somewhere in the middle ground, we find this weird tension between two truths. That it's not either or, but often it's both and. And it's in that we live our lives and we give expression to our faith. It's the same with our theology, really, and our, you know, our view on God and our living this out. Like we are constantly caught in this tension between one side and another. I mean, even what we believe about Jesus, he is fully God. That's big. That's massive. But he's also fully man. Wait, I thought he was. How can he? It's this tension, this mystery that we find ourselves in, and you can debate both, and yet it is not mutually exclusive. It is there together. And that's where we find wisdom, and that's where we find ourselves. And if we don't watch out, in our human way of dealing with things is that we get so drawn to the extreme point of view. Because the extreme point of view is a great tool for understanding things, but you can't live there. And we see that often, even in church world, church history, it's like, now we do this. And you know, like the whole church world does this, and then the pendulum swings the other way. And now we live like this and we believe this, and then the pendulum swings the other way. But really, it is somewhere in the middle ground. You see, our own lives, we can get into the point where we are like, it's all about what we can do for God. And then we focus on that, and really we start to neglect what God is doing in us. That we just focus on what he's doing through us, but we forget what he's also supposed to do in us. And Jesus says, what's the point if you save the whole world, yet you lose your own soul? And then we can reject that and say, we shouldn't be so focused on ministry, and I'm quitting every team, and I'm not volunteering. It's just me and Jesus and a few friends, and it's kumbaya, and here we are. And then we forget that there is a world around us that we're supposed to love and serve, but really it is somewhere in the middle ground. Paul in 1 Corinthians, the Apostle Paul, he's writing to this church, and he's really, you find him swinging between these two things. In 1 Corinthians 9, verse 19, he's basically saying, you know what? Whatever I need to do, I will do it in order to save people, in order to help people, in order to lead them to Jesus. I will do whatever it takes. He goes, if I've got to live like I'm under the law, even though I'm not under the law, I'll do that. If I have to live like I'm not under the law, I will do that. Basically, he's saying, I will do whatever it takes. If he's like, if I go to a restaurant, I will eat vegan meal if all my friends are vegans. That's a sacrifice, ladies and gentlemen. That's a true Christian. You know, he says, I will put restrictions on me that I don't even believe. If it is so that I can win someone else. He concludes it and he says, to the weak, I become weak to win the weak. I become all things to all people, so by all possible means, I might save some. I do this for the sake of the gospel, that I might share in its blessings. So he has this whole side of him where I'm like, I'm living my whole life so that other people might find Jesus. But then he goes to the other side, because there is one side where his whole life is about saving others, but there's also him realizing, but I cannot lose myself in this. I also have to realize I have my own race to run. I've got to, in this process of helping others to Jesus, I've got to make sure that I don't lose track of Jesus. And so he goes on in verse 24, and he says, do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? It's a bit like Manchester United playing Arsenal this week. You know, two teams playing, but only one got the prize. And we were so blessed to have someone over for dinner who was an Arsenal fan. It was a great joy. Not in a prideful way, just really just helping bring our Christ-likeness in my brother. I'm only saying that because he's here. Run in such a way as to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Therefore, I do not run like someone running aimlessly. So I'm not just running all over the place. No, I do not fight like a boxer beating the air. No, I strike a blow to my body and I make it my slave. So after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize. So in this whole context where Paul, he's talking about making sure we do things for others, he's like, let's not forget also just being who we're called to be. And it really comes back to that everything that we do should come out of who we are. That everything we do, it comes out of, like Proverbs 4 said, the condition of our heart. It's not mutually exclusive. That's why Jesus, it says in Mark chapter 3, verse 14, it says Jesus called 12 people that they might be with him and that he might send them out. So what we do comes out of who we are. It comes out of being with Jesus first. It all comes down to the condition of our heart. And this is where the challenge is. You see, when you talk to people that don't have any worldview of God, or maybe they haven't grown up with any faith, and you know, whatever the situation might be, I think one of the biggest challenges when talking to people with no sense yet of faith and God and man is that deep down, humanity thinks, and especially in our part of the world, we think that humans, deep down, we're good. Based on the overwhelming response, some in this room might believe that too. That deep down, we actually think we're good. I'm not bad. And a lot of that comes by comparison, doesn't it? Because we look around and I'm like, okay, I know I'm not good, but I'm gooder, you know, than them, you know. I look around, I go, well, I'm not a murderer, or I haven't stolen anything, and so I'm not like them, you know. Don't look to the person next to you, you know. Don't compare, you know. Geez, that's your husband, you know. So, you know, like we do that by comparison. We go, well, so deep down, there's this underlying thought. Well, I'm not bad. I mean, we're kind of good. And the problem with that is that if we have a default belief that humanity by itself is good, the problem is that the worldview that creates, the questions that create, are things like, well, why do bad things happen to good people? Because I'm good, so why should bad things happen? And it's like, you don't think you're part of the problem? You don't think that maybe part of the problem is humanity's selfishness? Part of the problem is that we are looking out for number one first? But the issue with that worldview is that, well, we don't need help. Save our souls, SOS? No, we don't need that because we're good in of ourselves. If there is anything bad in me, it definitely doesn't come from me. I'm only the way I am because my dad or my mom or this happened, and it has to be an outside influence that's caused me to make the decisions I'm making now. Because there is no way that deep inside of me that I would call myself evil or bad. No. We're good. And then we find ourselves to this conclusion that ultimately, if I'm good, then, well, in theory, I should be able to save myself. And there is a $1 billion or more than that industry on this, on self-help, that whatever issue you have, you don't need a savior. You can help yourself. You can think better. You can be better. You can do better. And while all of that is true, it does not fix the fundamental problem, and that is that we're broken. Now, it hasn't always been like that. We were created in the image of God. And when God looked at us, he said, this is good. You're good. I've done good. Creation is good. There's no sin. And so our default stance, our default decision-making was good, which is a crazy thought that we were like that as humanity. And then sin came in and broke the image, broke the picture. And suddenly now our intentions, our motive, it was driven by selfishness. It was driven by greed. It was driven about us. And this is what the Bible says in Romans 3:23, that all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. Which means all of us have made mistakes. All of us have something that we are ashamed about. But we try and do better. We try and get better. And we strive, and we might even create religious system. And religion, I think really it's just humanity's attempt to try and make sense of faith. Is that we try and set up all these religious systems between divine and mortal, and we try and figure out ways of getting there. And the whole issue with that, the whole challenge with religion is that it's about doing more. Do good to get good, and it's about outdoing all the bad that I've done. The challenge is, I don't know when have I done enough good to outdo all the bad. We look back and go, man, I've done some really bad stuff. I better do some extra good. I should give more. I should serve more. I should help a lot of old people over the road, you know. I should do more. Because then maybe the scale would tip towards good. Yet we never arrive. And what's the problem? We become tired, because we strive. I'm trying. And then this language, we might even become Christians with this mindset. And then we use language like, I'm not a very good Christian. What is that? What's a bad Christian? What's a good Christian? Well, in our mindset, it's someone that's doing the good stuff. The Bible never talks about that. It talks about a follower of Jesus or not a follower. It doesn't talk about a good or it doesn't, you know, quantify or create a quality on your followership. It's not like I'm really bad at following. You know, what is that? I mean, you know, no, you either follow or you don't. And we strive and we try and do more and we get tired. And then into the scene of a tired humanity, Jesus steps in with his famous words in Matthew 11:28. Are you tired? Are you worn out? Are you burned out on religion? Why don't you come away with me? Get away with me. Watch how I do it. Walk with me. Work with me. I'll show you how to take a real rest. Learn the unforced rhythms of grace. I'm not going to lay anything heavy or ill-fitting on you. Keep company with me and you will learn to live freely and lightly. Isn't it amazing? You were created for freedom. You were created for freedom. Ephesians 5:1, it's for freedom's sake. You were created for freedom. And the more like Jesus we become, the more we can follow his principles of living, the more, watch this, the more human we become. Because we were created in the image of God. C.S. Lewis talks about this, that what sin does, sin is just rebellion against God. What sin does is dehumanizes us. Because we were never meant to be like that. We were never meant to live like that. Sin destroys our humanity. So when we can make a decision and say, no, I want to be more like Jesus, the more human I become. The more I'm transformed into that image. Think about the first crime ever committed in the Bible. The first crime, Cain and Abel, they were brothers. Cain and Abel, they both brought a sacrifice before God. Abel brought a great sacrifice. Cain, he brought the leftovers. He brought the things that no one else wanted. And God rejected his sacrifice because it wasn't a sacrifice and accepted Abel. And Cain was jealous and he ended up killing his brother. You know, the whole thing was crazy. And then God speaks to Cain and they're having a conversation. And then in Genesis 4:7, God says to Cain, he goes, if you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at the door. Crouching tiger, hidden dragon. Sin is crouching, it's hiding at the door. And its desire is to have you. But you must rule over it. Now there is a hope in that sentence that you can master your desires. You can master the things, the bad habits. You can master the things that are trying to tear you apart. That are trying to tear your mind apart. That are trying to tear your marriage apart, your family apart. You can master it, but there's also a warning. It's saying sin is trying, it desires you. It wants to rule over you, but you should rule over it. So there is a warning, yet there is also a hope in the midst of that. Paul said it like this. I know I'm giving you lots of Bible today, but I haven't even said why I'm doing all of this, but we are on our verge of launching a 21 days February fast next Sunday. For those of you that want to be part of it, it's an invitation. Absolutely no expectation. You have to be part of it. It's just an invitation. And I want to lay the foundation of why we do that, of why we fast, of why we give up something in order to pursue God. Is that okay? But I don't know how many of you will recognize yourself in these verses. This is Paul. Paul in Romans 7, verse 15, he says it like this. What I don't understand about myself is that I decide one way, but then I act another. I do things I absolutely despise. So if I can't be trusted to figure out what is best for myself and then do it, it becomes obvious that God's command is necessary. But I need something more. For I know the law, but I still can't keep it. And if the power of sin within me keeps sabotaging my best intention, I obviously need help. I realize I don't have what it takes. I can will it, but I can't do it. I decide to do good, but I don't really do it. I decide not to do bad, but then I do it anyways. My decisions, such as they are, they don't result in actions. Something has gone wrong deep within me, and it gets the better of me every time. Does anyone recognize themselves? You know, I'm trying to do good, but I end up doing bad. I don't want to do bad, yet I do it. It happens so regularly, Paul says, that it's predictable. The moment I decide to do good, sin is there to trip me up, crouching, wants to overtake. I truly delight in God's command. Like, I want to be good. But it's pretty obvious that not all of me joins in that delight. Parts of me covertly rebel. And just when I least expect it, they take charge. I've tried everything and nothing helps. I'm at the end of my rope. Is there no one who can do anything for me? Isn't that the real question? The answer, thank God, is that Jesus Christ can and he does. He acted to set everything right in this life of contradictions where I want to serve God with all my heart and mind, but I'm pulled by the influence of sin to do something totally different. This is why Paul, he speaks to the Corinthians about mastering your own body. One translation says, I beat my body and I make him my slave. It's hard language. Now, it obviously doesn't mean he's beating himself. It's not about that. It's about I take control of my desires. I take control of who I am. That you control your desires. Your desires don't control you. That's what it's at. That's the heart of this. We're talking about the condition of your heart. That you can take control of who you are. I mean, he goes on in 1 Corinthians 10. He mentions examples of people that started out good. The Israelites in the desert, and people that saw great things for God, but then lost their internal being, lost their internal way. And Paul said, these are examples to us. Examples of people that had, you know, every intention of serving God. But then they got caught up in their desires. And he gives some examples of, you know, sexual desires and drunkenness and all these different things. And he gives them as examples for us of people that their desires got the better of them. And then he concludes it in 1 Corinthians 10:12. He says, so if you think you're standing firm, if you think you're strong, be careful that you do not fall. No temptation has overtaken you except what is common to mankind. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you could bear. Now listen, just a side note before we continue. Temptation, it's not just like a temptation to sin in terms of, you know, like the big stuff, like sexual sin or this sin or that sin. You know, often we think about temptation like, you know, one of the classic sins. But temptation is just when your faith fails. Failing to trust God. You can be tempted not to tithe. That's your faith not failing. That's your faith failing. That's not trusting God. You can be tempted not to forgive. You can be tempted not to pray. You can be tempted not to release someone. I mean, there are so many different ways. It's basically where your trust in God fails. So he says, there is no temptation that is every temptation, blah, 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 no temptation has overtaken you except what is common to mankind. So it's saying whatever you're facing, whatever struggle you're in right now, what your mind will tell you is, oh, you're the only one that's facing this. And Paul says, no, you're not. I mean, you're not. I mean, that's the temptation. Like, hey, that's the little bait. That's the deception. Don't tell anyone. You can't tell anyone that you struggle with this. You can't tell anyone that this is your battle. No. Tell people, because you will realize there's lots of us. Why? Because we're all humans. We're all humans. And no one fights alone. We're in each other's corner. And we're going to make sure we encourage each other in the middle of that fight. So he says it's common to mankind. And then he says God is faithful. Isn't that good news? God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, he will provide a way out so you can endure it. So he's saying if you are in a fight right now, there's two options. Either you're strong enough to go through it, or God will provide a way out. Either way, don't stop. Either way, don't quit. Either way, keep going. Because it's either in you to go through it, or he will provide a way out. Now, it says a way out that you can endure. That's annoying. That's really annoying. Because it's not a trap door. It's not a help. Bloop. Beam me up, Scotty. It's not that. It is not a, you know, like that. No, it is a way out, which means sometimes the fight is a fight of endurance. Sometimes it's like, oh, man, I want to be better. I don't want to give into this. I don't want to keep being like this person. You got to endure it. And everything inside of you is tearing you apart. Come on, give into this. Come on, do this. Come on, it will feel good. Come on, it's you know, if it feels good, do it. And you have to endure the way out. But we're not used to that because we live in a world where we're the product of evolution. So really, we are nothing but animals that we can just follow whatever instinct we have. But we're not animals. We don't live according to instinct. It's not just like, oh, it's mating season, let's have sex. No, we don't live by instinct. We live by choices. We are product of our choices. You don't have to live according to whatever feeling pops into your body or whatever thought pops into your head. You can stop. You can take a step back and you can respond and you can decide, is this the person that I want to be? Because I am the master of my feelings. I am the master of my body. I am not a slave to my sin. I'm not a slave to my feelings. I'm not a slave to my desires. No, I master it. That's what all of this is about. And that's what Jesus was trying to get at
when he spoke his most famous sermon, the Sermon on the Mount. You know, he's standing there and like, could you imagine being there when Jesus, he preached? He gets up and he's like, all right, guys, you've heard it say, you're not allowed to sleep around. And everyone's like, yeah, we've heard that. I'm telling you, you cannot even lust and look at another woman lustfully. And they're like, whoa. And then he says, and you've heard it say, you're not allowed to murder. I'm saying you cannot even be angry. And everyone's like, my goodness, Jesus had a bad morning. I mean, somebody give him a cup of coffee, you know. And really, it looks like that Jesus is changing the law. But he's not changing the law. He's interpreting it the correct way. He is saying to you, he's saying to the Israelites, hey guys, let me read it to you the way it was written. It's not about, well, you didn't kill anyone today, well done. No. It's a condition of your heart. Guard your heart. Because the Israelites had got to a point where many of us, we go, will be like, man, I'm so angry. And you're like, you know, weapons, you know, drawn. And we like, you know, there's fists in the air. We like in each other's faces. But then we walk away. Well, at least I didn't kill him. Well done to me. And Jesus is like, no, wait a minute. Like, no, back up a bit. It's down to the condition of your heart. You've heard it say you're not allowed to kill. That's, you need to read it. It's about clean hands, pure heart. It's about, you shouldn't even be angry. Because if you're not angry, you're not going to kill each other. The aim is not just, well, at least you didn't kill him today. Well done. You know, like, what a crazy society if that's what we come to. Come back high-fiving each other. Hey, honey, I didn't kill anyone today. Oh, babe, I'm so proud of you. No, Jesus, no, take a few steps back. It's about the condition of your heart. It's about, you should master your heart. You should control the desires. The desires shouldn't control you. So from next Sunday, we're inviting everyone who wants to join on a 3 weeks fasting. If you invite a friend today, you're like, oh my goodness, what are we? I just brought a friend, now we're talking about fasting. It's okay. We talk about fasting in pretty much every area of life these days. But I think it's good to talk about it in a church setting where it actually got invented. Next Sunday, we're gonna invite anyone. And you don't have to say to people whether you want to be part. You don't have to. It's just, it's an invitation. It's the February fast. It's just 3 weeks. It's 21 days where we just say, you know what? Let's choose something that maybe it takes up a bit too much space in our lives. Maybe it's a coping mechanism. Or maybe it's just a way of saying, this, I want to show myself. I want to show God two things. Number one, God, you mean more to me than this. Whatever it might be. 3 hours of Netflix a night, PlayStation, Red Dawn, I don't know, you know. You mean more to me than sugar. You mean more to me than wine. You mean more to me than coffee. Whew. You mean, Jesus, you mean more to, whatever it might be. That's one thing. The other thing is saying, this doesn't control me. This doesn't control me. I'm not an alcoholic. I just like to have like half a bottle of wine before I go to sleep. I'm not saying you're an alcoholic, but how about you prove it? Like, maybe it's just saying to ourselves, you know what? I want to take control of this. And for 21 days, I want to say to myself, you know what? I'm in control of my feelings. My feelings are not in control of me. I'm feeling a bit down. I need some sugar. How about you don't do that and you decide to read your Bible or pray or just say, hey, God, help. Help. Just habits. Things where we just say, why do we do this? Because, you know, faith is like a muscle. You've got to exercise it or it gets weak. And once it's weak, next time you've got to exercise faith, it's like, it's a bit harder because you haven't exercised your muscle. It's the same with your choices. Saying no, it's a muscle. It's a muscle you've got to exercise. The challenge is that too few of us, we don't know how to say no. And so we commit to things and then we fail in it because we are really good at giving our yes out, but really bad at giving our no out. That's why Jesus, he concludes all of this in Matthew. In Matthew 5, he says in Matthew 5:33, he talks about, you know, having an oath. Like, you know, people would say, I'll do this. I don't believe you. I swear. Nah. I swear by, and then they would say something. My mother's grave. I swear by God. I swear by something. And Jesus is like, no, we shouldn't live like that. Your word should be enough. And he says in Matthew 5, 37, he goes, let your yes be a yes and your no be a no. But we live in a society where we cannot commit to anything because we bless our yes, but we don't grow our no. But if we can grow our no and be good at saying no, it actually strengthens our yes. But we're not good at saying no. So we don't say no to others. We don't say no to pleasing people. We don't say no to our fears. We don't say no to our bad habits. We don't say no to things that we know are destructive. And then we end up in a situation where we go, man, I didn't even know I could do this. I'm not like this. I just couldn't help myself. Because we have never trained this muscle called no. And so what we're doing for 21 days is actually just strengthening the no muscle. And just saying, you know what? No. Oh, because you're not allowed to? It's got nothing to do with that. It's that I don't have to. And I'm proving to God, myself, and everyone around me that I'm in control of this. That I don't have to eat chocolate. Like, you know, milky chocolate, light chocolate. I don't have to eat dimes, you know. I don't have to eat, you know, these things. I don't have to have a glass of wine. I don't have to eat that. I don't have to have dessert 3 times every single night. I don't have to. I take control. I say no. I don't have to watch Netflix for 3 hours. I don't. Maybe I could watch it for 2 hours. 1 hour. Nothing at all. Maybe I could do something else. Read a book. Do a Bible study. We're going to do a Bible study together. Those of you who want to. I'm exercising my no muscle. Why? Because first of all, it's only Jesus that changes our hearts. So this is not about us changing us, because we cannot change our hearts. Only Jesus does that. But the second part of that is that we're creating pathways in our mind where we separate ourselves from the animals, saying, you know what? We're not going to live by instincts. We're going to live by choices. We are created in God's image in order to be able to make choices. And once you learn to say no, it gets easier. And this is what happens. You know, like creativity begets creativity. If you meet one person who's creative, it's crazy how that creates creativity in a whole nother area. You can sit and listen to music and get creative to draw a picture. Why? Because creativity, it spreads. It's the same with discipline. You get disciplined in one area of life, and it's amazing how it spills over in other areas of life. You start going to the gym regularly. You start like getting some discipline in one area of life. It spills over. Suddenly, you find yourself disciplined in other areas of life. Why? Because you're learning to say no. You're exercising a muscle in your life. And you're just taking charge. I think about Peter. The first time, you know, Peter, he just denied Jesus 3 times. Which one would have been the hardest no out of those three? Probably the first one. Because for 3 years, he had stood for Jesus. For 3 years, he'd made public statements about Jesus. Jesus, I'm not leaving. You know, for 3 years. And suddenly someone goes, hey, aren't you Peter? Weren't you with Jesus? Oh, you know, with him, you know, been around him, you know, I've seen him from a distance. No, I'm not with Jesus. Second time, hey, you sound like one of them. Aren't you? I've seen you. I've seen you on Instagram. You're with Jesus. No. Last time, a little girl. Hey, you with Jesus? Like, it's a girl, little girl. He's a grown fisherman. No. Because now the track's laid out. It's rolled out. And once you cross a line, it's so much easier to cross it again. Once we can take our no back, we're just redeeming our no. We're taking our no back. And we're saying, I'm in charge of what goes on in my life, not the other way around. Let me finish with this. Let me read this encouragement to the Corinthians again from the Message Bible. 1 Corinthians 9:24. You've all been to the stadium and you've seen the athletes race. Everyone runs, one wins. Run to win. All good athletes, they train hard. They do it for a gold medal that tarnishes and fades. You're after one that is gold eternally. I don't know about you, but I'm running hard for the finish line. I'm giving it everything I've got. No sloppy living for me. I'm staying alert and in top condition. I'm not going to get caught napping, telling everyone else about it, and then missing out myself. You see, once you realize what your yes is about, it makes it easier to know what to say no to.
Like the athlete that says, my yes is to get that gold medal. Well, it gets easier to say no to McDonald's. It gets easier to say no to sleeping in. It gets easier to say no to, you know, undisciplined living, because your yes is so strong. Once you say yes to Jesus, once you say yes to a healthy marriage, once you say yes to healthy thinking, once you say yes to healthy living, once you say yes to healthy finances, once you say yes to certain things in your life, it makes it easier to say no. Because your yes should be so strong. The challenge is that too many of us have given our no away. And we need to redeem it. We need to reclaim it. And that is why we're fasting. It is just to exercise our no muscle.